From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In an age of modern technology, board games can be a sort of oasis, a way to disconnect and just enjoy an experience with the people around you. A lot of new games have come out in recent years, but Monopoly remains as pervasive as ever, no matter how frustrated people may get with the game. A sort of mythology around its origin story took shape over time. As the story goes, in the 1930s, a man named Charles Darrow from Pennsylvania presented Monopoly to Parker Brothers as his own creation, a game he played to pass the time. Eventually, after the game took off in Philadelphia and New York City, Parker Brothers bought Darrow out, but he remained credited as the creator. But as author Mary Pollan puts it, there was only one problem. The story wasn't exactly true. Darrow was just the man who managed to capitalize on a game that had already been making its way around the country for a few decades. Where the story really begins is in the early 20th century, with a woman born in Macomb, Illinois, Elizabeth McGee, and her creation, The Landlord's Game. And it was only decades after her death that her effect on American culture began to be understood. For the first part of our show today, we're going to reflect on the legacy of the game she created. Mary Pollan opened the box on Monopoly's history a few years ago in a book called The Monopolists: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. She's a journalist and filmmaker who focuses mainly on sports and business. I originally spoke with Mary on the show back in May, on the anniversary of McGee's birth, as it happens. Because of that, we're not taking calls live today, but you can still let us know what you thought by leaving a voicemail at 217-300-2121. All right, here now is my conversation with Mary Pollan on the history of Monopoly. All right, Mary, I mentioned there are a few games that generate as much, fury, rage, take your pick, as Monopoly can do. Why is that?
Oh, that's such a great question. You know, Monopoly is a really unusual game in that it's intergenerational. So we often learn it from our parents or our grandparents. It's been around for a very, very long time. And I think that what I love about board games is they're almost like a form of role playing. So these sides of our personality that might be dormant otherwise can really come to the surface for better or for worse. You know, in the world of sports, you know, I can't tell you how many people I know who are siblings of elite athletes that are like, we never can play board games because they're so competitive. So I think it brings out the best and the worst of us and all that that can come with, you know, whether you're playing with your friends or family. Our emotions can get heightened very quickly in ways we often don't expect.
Oh my gosh, it sounds like you've played with my Seattle relatives when we get Trivial Pursuit out. And the smartphone has not been a social lubricant for those events. But sticking with Monopoly, I mean, there are hundreds, maybe thousands of versions of the game out there, official, unofficial. A Chicago edition, a Heinz ketchup edition for people who really like ketchup. Our producer Christine noted a version of the game that matches Scrabble and Monopoly. We played one with our kids. It's a Star Wars theme one a few weeks back. It's more commercial than ever, but you know, what looks new to you when you think back as to how, you know, where this game came from and how it's seen today?
You know what's fascinating about all these variations of Monopoly we see today is that in a weird way, I think people unknowingly are actually bringing it back to its folk game origins. So when Lizzie McGee receives her patent for the Landlord's Game in 1904, these sets, you know, they spread like wildfire, particularly throughout the Northeast. And when people made these pre-Parker Brothers boards, they personalized them. So if you were playing Boston, it would have the Boston Commons. If you were playing in New York City, you would have Broadway. And so I kind of chuckle when I see all these variations because I'm like, wow, a century later, here we are kind of still making the game our own. So I think it's actually kind of fitting and a little bit ironic. And it's fun. You know, I think that you still kind of get those core dynamics of the game, whether it's Star Wars or based off of a TV show or what have you, you still get people arguing and yelling at each other. So it's still like the core of the game is still really there.
Or rolling their eyes at how long it seems to take, but we can get into that. Let's go back in history, all the way back to the woman who started it all, Elizabeth McGee. I mentioned she was born in Macomb, 1866. What do we know about her early life, her influences at that stage?
Sure. So she was a really fascinating woman. And when I set out to do this book, I realized I was in trouble because I was like, I have to research someone who's famous for being obscure. But she has a really fascinating story. Her father, James McGee, was a very influential newspaper owner and political brain. He had traveled with Abraham Lincoln during the Lincoln-Douglas debates and had been around for the formation of the Republican Party. And I think that's important to understanding Lizzie McGee because she had access to technology, to media, to writing. And I think her father really infused a lot of his values in her and political curiosity, economic curiosity. And so she goes on to wear many hats. She had been a stenographer, and stenography was a really interesting rabbit hole I got into. Stenography was a way that women were able to access the workforce and be able to enter into offices and kind of more white collar professions that often they weren't allowed into. She was an actress. She wrote poetry. She wrote short stories. And she was very interested in the political teachings of a man named Henry George. To be honest, when I started working on the book, I didn't know that much about Henry George, but in his day, he was a huge deal. He wrote this book called Progress and Poverty that was a massive bestseller. He was very interested in single tax theory, which I won't go into a ton of detail on. I'm not an accountant. I'm not a single tax theory expert by any stretch. But she becomes, you know, single tax clubs were all over the country, all over the world, really. And Lizzie McGee was really interested in this. And that's what she decides she really wants to use when she designs this game. She wants to create a game to teach people about Henry George and his philosophy. You know, and she does. She creates the landlord's game. She gets a patent, which I found extraordinary because, you know, at the turn of the century, the head of the U.S. Patent Office was saying, you know, women don't even bother applying. We're not going to approve it. And she uses her initials. She's very clever. And so she gets a patent as a woman before women could even vote. By the time she dies in 1948, though, and we can go into more detail about the monopoly of it all, but she was really obscure. She was working as a receptionist in Washington, D.C. Nobody really knew her contributions to gaming history, that she had created this game. And the best we can tell, she made $500 off of it. And only just a couple of weeks ago did the New York Times run an obituary on her. They're doing this really fascinating project where they're looking at overlooked people. They wrote this huge obituary for Charles Darrow, and, you know, inventor is in the headline, inventor of Monopoly dies. And only, you know, decades later has the record been corrected. So if you want to read more about that, you can, you know, find that on their website. But I thought it was pretty cool that all this time later, finally, we've realized, you know, her obituary needs to include all of this.
Yeah, she's getting her due. So talk about we don't have to make this a tax lecture, but talk about how that political philosophy and some of those other ideas influenced the landlord's game, how that was sort of made real for people.
Sure. So what's really fascinating to me is that if you look at some of the writings that, you know, Henry George was putting out there, that his followers were putting out there, they almost look like they're ripped from the headlines today. That we're still arguing about a lot of the same things. So very briefly, you know, the Georgists are very interested in land and taxation and how land is taxed. In Georgist philosophy, you know, often there's a lot of questions and skepticism about landlords. You know, which as a longtime New Yorker now in LA, I related to a lot of the angry discussion about rents being jacked up. And there's a couple of single tax colonies that you can still visit. One is in Arden, Delaware, where I did a lot of book research. And it's fascinating because there's like a big public square. So there's this emphasis on public land versus, you know, if it's privately held, who gets taxed on it and how. So it's no surprise that her game is called the landlord's game. And I think when you zoom back and look at what was happening at that time, you know, we in America had this incredible amount of wealth that was being created and concentrated in very few hands. You know, you think about the railroad barons, the steel barons. And so she, you know, think about Teddy Roosevelt and trust busting.
This is the Gilded Age? Do I have that right? Yeah.
Kind of the lead up into it, which I was a huge fan of that. So, you know, she's one of the many people that's kind of questioning, whoa, like, how is this being taxed? Who controls the wealth? What are, you know, the conversations we need to be having around that? So when she creates the landlord's game, she actually has two rule sets. There's a monopolist rule set, which goes on to what we now know today as monopoly, and an anti-monopolist rule set in which you're breaking things apart. And I've always thought it was fascinating that we were given these two options as human beings, and we all went to the more evil like version, the thing where we clobber each other. And, you know, when I go and I talk about this book, I often have parents who say, well, Monopoly is a terrible game because it teaches kids bad things about the economy. You know, I personally don't believe we need to destroy each other to be successful. You know, I think the pie of success is large and everybody can have slices, right? That my success does not depend on destroying other people. And I think that's exactly what her design, her point was. We've just kind of lost it, you know, over time. I don't think many people, if you grab someone off the street and said, oh, Monopoly, that they would go, oh, right, that Henry George single tax theory game. But it is interesting that that's the one that when people complain about how terrible it is to lose at Monopoly, I think that was exactly her point.
What talk about the role of board games in people's life at this time, because I think maybe we don't appreciate it now when we have so many entertainment options in the home in the evening, for example, or on the weekends.
Absolutely. So board games are, you know, that's almost like a book of its own. But I did a lot of research on Milton Bradley and the Parker Brothers Company. And at this time, you know, board games are a huge deal. You know, this is obviously before television, before a lot of mass media. And this is also, you know, we start to see child labor laws and electricity, and that people are actually having the time to play these games. And then and now, you know, games are a really good value for your buck, right? So you can go to a baseball game, but then the game is over and then there goes your money. But you can buy one game, and that can really last, you know, time and time again, and you really get a lot of fun out of it. You know, there's research. We've been playing games as long as we've been human beings, right? It goes back to Mesopotamia. There's a really long, rich history there. But Monopoly really comes about at a time when American lifestyles are changing. And I think that that's also, you know, when you think about, we take for granted so much today, but it's like, oh, wow, electricity changes a city, right? It changes how we can spend time. So I think board games, you know, the Parker Brothers Company was founded in the mid 1800s. It had been around a long time, but there's also this shift, you know, Milton Bradley, he was one of the early advocates of the kindergarten movement. He really saw games as a tool to teach, you know, things about morality. The original Game of Life, which was the Milton Bradley game, had like a suicide square. It was really dark. It was really morbid. It kind of reflects, I think, at that time, how just death permeated culture. I'm not somebody who feels a lot of nostalgia. I'm very glad to be alive in 2024, partially because when I look back at some of these games, which I very much see as works of art or cultural artifacts, the same way we would look at books or music, I'm like, wow, life was rough back then. And as Monopoly starts to take off, you know, it's interesting that she's using it as a teaching tool because there's this really rich history of games as educational tools, but they're also becoming more fun and more recreational. You know, in the 1920s, there was a huge Mahjong craze in the United States. So games are kind of shifting from almost like medicinal and like serious and dark to fun and ways that people can spend more time and they've got more time to have fun. Again, we take that for granted, that fun is in some ways like almost like a new revolutionary thing that's happening as workplace culture and styles are changing.
Yeah, fun. There was a book that came out a few years ago on the labor movement. I think it was titled was something like From the People Who Brought You the Weekend.
Exactly. Which,
what is a weekend, to quote the grand dame from Downton Abbey? A couple minutes until we need to take a break, but let's get back to McGee. How does this game start spreading beyond her?
Sure. So when she creates this game, it spreads, you know, and this was like a really fun part of the research. And later, Ralph Anspach, who we can talk about more, he has a lawsuit in the 70s where he finds a lot of these early players. So from 1904 to the early 1930s, it spreads among like a who's who of left-wing America at the time. It's played at a lot of Ivy League universities. Scott Nearing, who is an academic and a socialist and a kind of an early father of the greed movement, he was playing it. Ernest Angel, who co-founded the ACLU, he was playing it. Upton Sinclair, the author of The Jungle, famous muckraker, he was playing it. So it really gains popularity among like this pretty impressive list of political thinkers. It's played at Arden, Delaware, which is this single tax colony I mentioned, but it was also a vacation spot and a place where a lot of, you know, people like the Upton Sinclairs of the world would gather. And then people would take the game back to their school. It was played at Harvard. It was played in the Midwest. It went as far as, I believe, Indiana. So the game is, you know, gaining a lot of popularity and traction, and people really love it. And like I said, they're modifying it. And one of the groups that really loves the game are the Quakers in Atlantic City. And Atlantic City We have a whole chapter in the book about, you know, how Atlantic City kind of pioneers a lot of the hotel world. Atlantic City, like Philadelphia, like New York City, is really this place where a lot of different cultures and communities are coming together. And what I found fascinating about the Quaker piece of this is that the Quakers make some key tweaks to the game. So silence is a big part of the Quaker faith, and they don't like a lot of the loud auctioning that's going on in Monopoly. So they put fixed prices and they put Atlantic City properties on it, right?
Yeah. And, so the board game that people know today as Monopoly has those Atlantic City titles. All right, we're going to put a pin in that for a little bit. We'll leave that as a tease because we do need to take a short break, and we will continue talking about how this Monopoly game reached the mainstream. It was originally created as the Landlord's Game by Elizabeth McGee, who was born in Macomb, Illinois, but eventually she was written out of that history. We're talking about this with author Mary Pallon. Her book is The Monopolists: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. More to come after a short break. This is The 21st Show. Stay with us. This is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking today about a woman named Lizzie McGee, now understood to be the creator of the game that went on to become Monopoly. She was born in Macomb, Illinois, 1866. She had a precocious entry into the world of work and wasn't one to keep her head down at a time when women were still pretty marginalized in American society. She invented this game, and as we're discussing, it grew beyond her, and eventually, she was written out of this history, at least for a while. We're talking about all this with Mary Pallon, journalist and author of a book called The Monopolists: Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. We originally had this conversation back in May on the anniversary of McGee's birthday. You will hear that come up a little later. So while we aren't taking calls live, we do still appreciate hearing from you about what we've talked about. You can email us. The address is talk@21stshow.org. Let's get back to the conversation as I shared a thought from a member of our texting group. David in Mount Morris said he will only participate in this conversation if I get to be the shoe. Enough said. Mary, do you have a favorite piece? Do you even play Monopoly anymore after spending so much time with it?
I played as the dog when I was a kid, but let it be known, I'm the youngest of six cousins. I'm the little sister in my family. You can write the book on this and your family will still argue with you about the rules. So it has not settled any of our family disputes, much to my chagrin. But yes, I do still play. We play at Christmas. That was our tradition growing up. And we still play around the holidays.
I got to say, when we played with our kids for the first time, and it was my first time in, I don't know, decades probably playing the game. And goodness, those rules are pretty confusing, I will say. And so I can see where people are sort of inventing their own. But I digress. So let's get back to you were talking about the game, its growing popularity in Atlantic City in particular. And that gives some of the property names we're used to and the influence of the Quakers. How does Charles Darrow come into this story?
Yes. So the plot thickens. So it's a version of this Atlantic City game that the Quakers are playing that Charles Darrow, a friend of his, teaches him, Charles Todd. So Charles Todd is a man who's living in Philadelphia, as is Charles Darrow. And he hosts the Darrows, Charles Darrow and his wife, for a Monopoly night, which was very much the custom. And, you know, these two couples play the game, they enjoy it. And then shortly thereafter, Charles Darrow reaches out to Charles Todd and says, I loved that Monopoly game. Would you mind having your secretary type up the rules? And Charles Todd kind of thinks this is strange. You know, imagine if you went to someone's house and played checkers or a game that had been around for, 30 years at this point. But nonetheless, he does it. And then Darrow takes a version of that game and then goes and sells it to Parker Brothers. I think something about the story that I always try to remind myself in working on the book was, you know, no one knew that Monopoly was going to become the blockbuster that it did. And I don't think anybody really anticipated that it would be a multi-generational hit. A hit in the board game world is so hard then and now. And so Darrow sells this game, and something else really interesting happens, which is that when Parker Brothers starts putting out this game, the Darrow story, the Cinderella story that he, during the Great Depression, goes into his basement and innovates, that becomes part of the marketing of the game. That was really unusual. Nobody really cared who invented games. It wasn't like, oh, I'm going to see a movie because this actor is in it, or read a book because I love this author. So Parker Brothers realizes they have a problem. They start getting letters from people that say, this guy didn't invent this game. I played this game in the 19-teens, in the 1920s. And yet they dig in their heels and they strike up this deal with Lizzie McGee, who is not happy about this Darrow invention story. She's as shocked as anybody to see the Monopoly game being sold. And she calls up journalists with the Washington Evening Star and the Washington Post. And she does these interviews where she is holding up her board games. She has her patent. She renewed her patent in 1924, concurrent with patent law. And she's angry. And she says, I invented this game. And here's all the documentation and the evidence to prove it. This is the part of the story where anybody who's a lawyer says she needs a lawyer in the room. Unfortunately, by all evidence we have, that's not what happened. Parker Brothers strikes up a deal. They promise to put out a couple more of Lizzie McGee's games. At first, she's really excited about this because she thinks My Georgist Ideals are going to be out there, you know, published by Parker Brothers. But there's no evidence that they really made any earnest effort to put those games out there or credit her. And by the time she dies, you know, one of the last traces we have of her is the 1940 U.S. Census. And of all the things that she did, she lists her occupation as maker of games, and her income is zero. So it was a pretty sad ending for Lizzie McGee for a long, long time.
How does Charles Darrow, I mean, Parker Brothers, so, I mean, he was getting royalties. She was not, right? I mean, he came to be associated with this game for generations before anyone or most people knew her name.
Correct. And the only reason we're talking about any of this right now is because of a very unlikely set of circumstances. This man named Ralph Ansbach, who was an economics professor living in the Bay Area in the 1970s, he created a game called Anti-Monopoly, and he goes out and sells it, and it's kind of this counterculture hit, and then he gets a cease and desist letter from Parker Brothers. And I think most of us, if we got a scary letter, would kind of back off or, like, you know, be scared. That's not Ralph. That's not who this guy is. He goes on what ends up becoming a 10-year-long legal battle that goes to the steps of the Supreme Court over his right to make his anti-monopoly game. And in that process, he becomes like a real life monopoly detective and sleuths out the original origins of the game. So my book is the story of Ralph and kind of his arc and what happened to him, but then also this history that he tracked down. And it's kind of incredible. You know, his fate and Lizzie McGee's became so intertwined, yet these are two people who never met and they were united by this game in the strangest way.
What does this story say about gender and, you know, sidelining inventors? I mean, is this a classic old story? Is this just Parker Brothers trying to sweep someone under the rug for monetary purposes? How do you think about that?
That's a great question. It's been fascinating. You know, the book came out in 2015, which may as well, I mean, it was such a different world then. And I remember, like, I would, you know, get these emails from people about how shrill and angry and, you know, just, and then, you know, you have the Me Too movement. I think the optics around this have changed quite a bit. And I think that the world is full of Lizzie McGee's. I think it's full of women who were inventing, who were there all along. I think there's this myth, you know, I work in the world of sports, and often there's this myth that, like, women don't play sports, women don't do this. And that's not what the record bears out. I'm amazed that we have the documentation to tell Lizzie McGee's story. I think, you know, documentation itself is a privilege, right? This is the Hamilton of it all. Like, who lives, who dies, who tells your story, right? And I think that there were tons of women doing all sorts of incredible things and we know this now. And so, you know, I typically work in, you know, documentaries and newspapers where I'm working with living people and telling their stories. This was really the first time I almost had to kind of, like, raise the dead a little bit and go back. And I did a first draft of the book and had to go back and realize that I didn't really understand the context for what it took, the headwind that a woman faced in 1904 to get a patent for game design. You know, we still have a lot of issues with gender and game design and business today, but like more than a century ago, I really had to go back and think about what did that look like? What kind of chess would she have had to engage in to, you know, even get a patent and get some of this stuff worked out? So, you know, when you look at the depositions from the OnSpot case, there's a lot of language in there that's very dismissive of her, and they kind of write her off as this political, you know, quack, and things that today wouldn't, you know, I could feel like a PR person kind of cringe at, but were pretty normal. And if anything, subdued relative to how women were discussed and depicted at that time.
Yeah, and there's so much in the book about that detective story you mentioned about uncovering these real origins. But I want to, since we are an Illinois show and this is the anniversary of Lizzie McGee's birth, I do want to stick with her story a little. Can we go back and just talk about the world when she created this game? You mentioned she was, you know, entering the world of work through stenography was in secretarial opportunities were changing life for women. Talk about at one point she takes out an ad in the newspaper, a pretty unusual ad. I'm not sure how well it ages as they say through 2024 years, but I mean, it certainly made an interesting point and quite a splash at the time.
Yes, it was a huge deal at the time. So when Lizzie McGee, she takes out this ad, you know, where it's kind of almost like a stunt. So she puts out this advertisement and she offers herself for sale as a young woman American slave to the highest bidder. And she kind of gives this description of what she looks like, that she's philosophical, she's got big eyes. You know, it's reads as a little sarcastic almost, that she has like strong bohemian characteristics, which I thought was kind of an amazing quote. You know, she's religious but not pious. Talks about kind of her skills in typewriting. She was 40 at the time, which would have been well beyond what I think society would have considered kind of the quote unquote appropriate age for marriage. And this went crazy. I mean, this story, this ad was picked up, you know, in newspapers across the country, and people just thought it was so audacious. And she talks about, you know, that girls have minds and desires and ambition. And she talks about how she wants equal pay. Again, this is, it felt like it was like stripped from the headlines today in some ways. So I think it said a lot about her and just her boldness, that she was very much an advocate for women's rights, not afraid to speak about it really publicly and really put her neck out there. She didn't, you know, I don't know how much she would have cared about how she was being perceived in terms of, you know, if this is so crazy. And she gets all these responses. You know, she gets people who write in and say everything from like, yeah, I'll marry you, to, you know, one guy who, you know, puts out this offer to have her pose as a freak, his word, in a dime museum. So I think it also says a lot about the world at that time, that her doing something like this was so audacious and the response to it was so strong. It's been, you know, I'm a woman who obviously like was born, you know, in the 80s. And I think it's really easy to forget kind of the lineage of history and everything that happened before, so that we could vote, so we could work, so we could have, you know, places. I think when I was going through these archives, I was like, wow, this is, it wasn't that long ago. It feels like it was a long time ago, but there's a lot that I know I personally take for granted.
It's the tagline from the tobacco company, "We've come a long way," or something like that. Or you've come a long way.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
Let's play a voicemail. We got a listener from this is Tana from Menard County, wanted to share a memory of Monopoly.
We'd play in the snow and build caves in the snow drifts and so on and so forth, and then we'd come in and we'd warm up and have, I don't know what we had, cocoa or something, and play Monopoly. And boy, was that fun, and do I have such good memories of playing Monopoly. And then my daughter really was loved Monopoly too.
All right. Thank you so much for sharing that memory. You know, I want to come back to this idea of this game as an educational tool, since that was one of Lizzie McGee's intended legacies of what, or effects of what she was trying to do. Did you feel like, in retrospect, you were being educated about the way the world really works when you were playing this game?
Yes and no. I was, believe it or not, like a super shy kid. And one of the things I think I love about Monopoly is it really encourages deal making. So I think I learned a lot about negotiating. I learned a lot about observing. I think really good Monopoly players aren't just paying attention to what they're doing, they're paying attention to what the other players are doing when it's not their turn. So I think it teaches a lot about engagement, paying attention. It's interesting. My first job was as a financial journalist, and I do think that this game and I've never really had numbers anxiety or anxiety about talking about real estate or money. In fact, I ended up doing it for a living. Like I find it really fascinating and understanding economics. So I think it's a really good way to kind of bring in some of that vocabulary, ask questions, engage with kids about these topics that sometimes can either be boring or hard to breach. One of the things I think is so incredible right now is there's a version of Monopoly that you can buy where you use credit cards. Which I'm like, oh my gosh, when I heard that, I was like, what would Lucy McGee think of that? And so, but credit cards are a real thing in the world now, and you do need to talk to kids about, it's not unlimited money, right? And so I think it's also evolving as the economy and our personal finances are evolving as well.
Yeah, most of us don't get to be landlords either. Just a couple of minutes left in our time together. What is, broadly speaking, what is McGee's legacy today, whether people realize it or not?
That's a really wonderful question. I think it's still evolving, but I think, I've been blown away in the years since the book has come out to see it be received. I think that Lizzie McGee's are North Stars. I think it's really important, particularly as we talk about women in STEM, women in history, that people know that there was somebody out there doing this so long before. And that's really powerful. And so I think it's been really heartening to see. Lizzie McGee was in a Jeopardy clue. The National Women's History Museum has done, like, she's taught at schools now. It's just been so cool for me to see that story. And then, people come up to me at these book events, be they game designers or coders or, from all walks of life and say, wow, it is so cool that, we know about this woman who did something like this. So I think her legacy is still evolving, but I think it's also just powerful that she kept on trucking and that she put an offering out there that we all are still enjoying today. And it's part of so many people's treasured memories. And I think that's just really great. I think that's a really, I love the idea that somebody, can create art or create a work that can endure long beyond they're, alive and have this kind of evolution of its own. I mean, it's amazing. It's amazing that, over a century later, we're sitting here talking about this game still.
Well, thanks in no small part to your work bringing her Lizzie McGee's story to life. Mary, thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thanks so much for having me.
Mary Pilon is a journalist and author of several books, including The Monopolists, Obsession, Fury, and the Scandal Behind the World's Favorite Board Game. We're going to take a break. Before we go, we do want to hear what you think about what we've been talking about, not just today, but anytime in these past few weeks or months. Whether you liked it or didn't like it, if you think we got something wrong or we got something right, let us know. You can leave a voicemail anytime at 217-300-2121, 217-300-2121. All right, we need to take a short break. When we come back, we'll be talking about peanut allergies, healthcare recommendations, and how parents think about keeping their children safe. This is the 21st Show. Stay with us.